I've not taken the time, any time this week to use up any preaching time with plaudits, although they certainly would have been deserved, and perhaps I'll have more to say about this later, but very briefly, let me just say that I like this church, and I like the pastor, the pastor's wife, marvelous hospitality that's being extended, and the food the ladies are bringing to this church. I don't have enough adjectives to describe just how good it is to have the fellowship and the fine food and the kind things that you're doing and saying to make my stay here so pleasant. But I want you to know that I thank you for that. You can't look at me and tell unless you see how wide I'm getting down here around the belt line. But whether you can see it or not, or whether you can even feel it or not, I'm very grateful for your kindness. Now, my text tonight is in the same chapter as it was last night, Ezekiel chapter 38. The reason I want to read those verses of Scripture once again is because I want to talk about one particular country that is mentioned in that 38th chapter of Ezekiel. And whatever I have to say about that one country would also be appropriate to say about any of the countries that are mentioned here. And by that I mean that I'm talking tonight about the Muslim world. I'm going to talk particularly about Iran because it seems to be the one that's more on everyone's mind than any of the other Middle East countries at present. But whatever I would have to say about Iran could also be said. I could make another sermon and just change the name to some other country, such as, for example, Libya, and change the current events just a little bit. What has been said and is being said in the newspapers today about that country or one of the others that are named, and everyone would be the very same thing in content. Ezekiel chapter 38, starting in verse 1, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his band, the house of Togarmah of the north quarter, and all his bands, and many people with thee. Okay, that's enough. And we'll pay particular attention to what is said there about one particular country. I'm going to have to go through a little ritual right here for the next few moments that means nothing to any of you except to me. See, I have a kind of a problem that is a characteristic of people about my age, and that is there's a sort of a no man's land between what can be seen with my prescription glasses out at a distance and what can be seen without any glasses at all up real close, and then right out there just about at the tips of my fingers is sort of a no man's land. And I got to where I couldn't read my Bible too well unless I held it up in my hand. So I used a very scientific means of solving that problem. I got a piece of string and tied it onto the side of my glass frames and stretched it down to the Bible board on my pulpit. Took it down to the optometrist and said, I want you to make me a pair of glasses where I can read perfectly at that distance right there. And I held that string out for him, and so he fixed me up, and that helped quite a bit. And I recommend that to any of you folks who are about my age and having problems like that. There are lots of people who have private opinions about the Iranian situation. And as you very well know, the Iranian situation is not quite as prominent in the newspapers today as it was a few months ago when our American hostages were still there after having been there for more than a year. Nevertheless, that kingdom that we call in the present day Iran is mentioned quite prominently in the scriptures, and it is called Persia. And that's what the prophet Ezekiel called it when he wrote this prophecy about God and Magog coming down upon the land of Israel in the last days. Someone asked me last night, exactly when will that battle of Gog and Magog take place? And I very frankly admit that I do not know the exact time. Could it be, he said, just before the Lord comes? I think it could be. Could it be right after the Lord comes, before the midpoint in the tribulation period? I think it could be. I have a number of brethren whose opinions I respect highly who think that it is the same battle as the Battle of Armageddon, perhaps just the first skirmish of the Battle of Armageddon. That might be and it might not. I have a preference to believe that it comes before the midpoint in the tribulation period, but I'm not going to fuss about it, and the reason I'm not is because I frankly don't know. Now, I console myself in my ignorance with the knowledge that you don't know either. You see, God has held back just enough of the details of prophecy to keep any of us from being a smart aleck about it. And so we just don't really know the exact time for the fighting of this battle. But we do know positively, precisely, who is going to participate in this battle when Russia comes against the kingdom of Israel. If you were to look at a map of the, quote, Middle East tonight, you would see that of that vast territory around the Persian Gulf and the Mediterranean Sea, there is one tiny little piece of geography that is the present-day nation of Israel. And if you were to look on the north side, on the east side, and the west side for that matter, and then down on the south side of that little piece of geography, you would find that around Israel, like the jaws of a giant pair of pliers, some kind of a pincer, there would be these various countries that are spoken of in the prophecy of Ezekiel. Russia on the extreme north, and then just below Russia, Turkey on the one hand, Iran on the other hand, a little bit farther south from there would be Syria, and out of the Syrian kingdom, just a tiny little section that is called Lebanon, and then Israel. Over on the east side of Israel, the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, joined by Saudi Arabia, and then Pakistan and Afghanistan, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then coming down to the south, around the mouth of the Persian Gulf, there are the United Arab Emirates, the country of Iraq, the two Yemens, Aden, and then the northern part of the African continent comes up just to the south of Israel, and in the very northernmost part of the African continent, there is Egypt, of course, and then Libya, who is mentioned here in the prophecy of Ezekiel as being one of those countries that will come against the land of Israel in the battle of Gog and Magog. So it's easy to see from a military standpoint that Israel is shoved right up against the Mediterranean Sea on the left, on the west, rather, and all of these other countries surrounding her. Now, what do these countries have in common? They're not allied with Russia. Except in some cases they are. Libya, for example. Mr. Gaddafi is very much an avowed communist. But what do they have in common? There is one thing that all of them have in common. And that is, they are all of one religion. And that is the Muslim religion. Iran is mentioned in there, but I say again that whatever I say about Iran could also perhaps be said about any of these other Muslim countries that are mentioned there in the Scripture. Iran is ancient Persia. If you do a little bit of research, you would find that for a great many years in the history of the world, this country that we now call Iran was once the most powerful nation in the world. When Cyrus was king of Persia, it was in fact the occupying force for just about all of that Middle East country. Iran originally was divided into two kingdoms. Up on the northern part were the Medes, and in the southern part, which was known as the Kingdom of Persis, were the Persians. And incidentally, that's where the expression came from, the Medes and the Persians. They decided to unite their kingdom under Cyrus. When they united, the Medes had their laws, the Persians had their laws, and they didn't trust each other, even though they were going to amalgamate together into one united kingdom. So in their constitution, in the United Kingdom, they made one primary law that said that any time there was a law of either the Medes or the Persians, that it could not be overturned. The Medes couldn't overturn any of the Persian laws, the Persians couldn't overturn any of the Median laws, and consequently, there was an expression that got into our vocabulary. It's like the law of the Medes and the Persians, meaning that it's something that cannot be overruled or overturned or undone. It's that kind of a constitutional primary law. The Medes and the Persians used to fight each other very bitterly, like the North and the South in this country did at one time. And then in 550 B.C., when Cyrus became the king of the combined kingdoms, it became a very powerful force in the Middle East. When Cyrus died, there was a king by the name of Darius who took over. And incidentally, he was the king of Persia during the days of Queen Esther in the Bible. The Persian Empire at one time ruled all of Southwest Asia, plus many parts of Europe. Finally, it became a victim to Alexander the Great in the Grecian Empire that Alexander established. And then in 641 A.D., it became a complete Muslim nation under the leadership of a great Muslim prophet, in fact, the founder of the Muslim religion, by the name of Muhammad. In the 1600s, Persia became again a monarchy, and the man who came to power was known as the Shah of Persia, or the Shah of Iran. And then there was a succession of father, son, grandson, great-grandson, and so on down the line, until about 2 years ago, when the Shah of Iran was completely deposed, and there is no monarchy there at the present time. During the First World War, Persia became a neutral nation, refused to fight on either side, and continued that neutrality up until the Second World War, and wanted to remain neutral in World War Number Two. However, there was a problem developed. Russia on the north was allied with Great Britain, and Great Britain was the occupying power in Jordan, which is just on the south part of Iran, and it became necessary for Great Britain to ship supplies across Iran into Russia in order to have the right kind of flow of war materials during the war. So they made a kind of a deal that they would have a weaponless warfare with Iran. And what I mean by that is the British invaded Iran from the south, the Russians invaded Iran from the north, no shots were fired, no people were killed, but this gave the Shah of Iran justification, the motivation that he needed to make his kingdom a part of the war, so he declared war on Germany and did become one of the Allied powers during the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, the Shah of Iran demanded that these occupying forces, Great Britain and Russia, retire from his country. Britain, of course, did that almost immediately. But Russia refused to do it unless the Shah of Iran would sign a contract with him giving Russia permission under a treaty to develop the oil resources in the northern part of Iran in the Kurdish section, K-U-R-D section of Iran. And the Shah of Iran, in order to get the Russians to pull out, finally did sign that treaty. However, the parliament of Iran revoked the treaty in 1947, and since that time there's been a great deal of animosity between the Persian kingdom and the Russians because of that. Iran is in a very strategic spot in the Middle East, joined to Russia and the Caspian Sea on the north side, Afghanistan and Pakistan on the east, the Persian Gulf on the south, and Iraq and Turkey on the west. A few years ago, as a matter of fact, up until only about 2.5 years ago, Iran was the strongest ally the United States had in the Persian Gulf region, except for Israel itself. A very strong friend of both the Western powers and of Israel. Now, just to show you how fast, how rapidly prophecies can be fulfilled. Ezekiel said in his prophecy that in the battle of Gog and Magog, Persia was going to be allied with Russia. And Persia was going to be a part of that force that will come down and fight against the kingdom of Israel. And I very well remember just a few years ago when some of our brethren who were very perceptive in the scriptures would read in the Bible, in Ezekiel's prophecy, where Persia is going to be against Israel in the battle of Gog and Magog, and they would say that can't possibly be, because Persia is one of our strongest allies today, and Persia is one of the staunchest friends Israel has in the Middle East. And I tell you, I don't know how you feel, but I just get a thrill in my heart when I see how in my lifetime, within the last 24 months, the pages of the newspaper have caused the prophecies of the Bible just to leap into life and to be fulfilled right here before our very eyes. Today, religious and political tension is sweeping the Middle East as never before. Have you noticed that there is a common denominator in that tension in the Middle East, that all of it seems to be against the United States, against the allied Western powers? Western-oriented nations such as Turkey and Egypt have been severely criticized for being friends of the United States. When Mr. Sadat was assassinated yesterday, the Western nations were the ones who extended their condolences, who sent telegrams of sympathy to the widow. And what did the surrounding Arab nations, the Muslim nations, do? They got out in the streets and had a parade and rejoiced because of this. And that within itself tells us something about how prophecy is being fulfilled in the Bible. Because only a short time ago we were saying the best friend we have in the Middle East is Iran. Today we're saying one of the strongest anti-United States forces in the Middle East is Iran. As a matter of fact, during the last 2 years, the United States has either reduced or evacuated its personnel from 14 different Islamic countries. On the surface, just on the surface, it may appear that the villain is the military and the political and the technological superiority of the Western nations and of Israel itself. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that what we see on the surface, the superiority in fighting power and the superiority in political power of these Western nations, I don't believe that is the real reason why those nations are against the United States. Jealousy, just ordinary behavioral jealousy, doesn't run that deep among these people. So what's behind it? And what is that deep-seated underlying resentment that those Middle East countries seem to have against the Western nations? Because they are friends of Israel. Now, if they would become enemies to Israel, Great Britain, France, the United States, West Germany, if any of those allied powers would become enemies to Israel, they would almost overnight become friends of just about any of those countries in the Middle East. Well, why is that? Now, that is something that we can answer positively from the Bible. You and I know very well, if you've ever studied the Bible very much at all, you know that the real reason goes back to the two sons of Abraham. Remember that Abraham was the father of two sons. The oldest one was the son of Abraham and his wife's servant, Hagar. His name was Ishmael. He became the father of all of those today who are in that, quote, Muslim world in the Middle East. Isaac became the true heir of Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on down through the line to the present-day nation of Israel. You remember the other night I told you that God made a covenant with Abraham, the terms of which have never been repealed, that Abrahamic covenant. A lot of people, though, do not realize that God also made a covenant with his son Ishmael. He made a covenant with him that said, I will give you a certain portion of land. And it's easy for you to take your Bible and read through the scriptures and find where the Lord gave a certain geographical territory to the descendants of Ishmael. But there was always that resentment between these two sons of Abraham, Ishmael and Isaac. It's a very deep, a very radical hatred, and it still underlies the entire Muslim world today. So I think that behooves us to take a little closer look at those people, the descendants of Ishmael, and find out what they are religiously and what motivates them to have such strong, deep convictions against the nation of Israel. What do we actually know about the Islamic religion? You know, we have deprived ourselves, and we've cheated ourselves down through the years because we have studied the tenets of Christianity. We have studied the various dogmas of Christianity, from Roman Catholicism on the one hand to the ultra-conservative missionary Baptist on the other hand, and all of the different faiths in between. And sometimes we have made a special study of the Jewish religion because we seem to relate to it more because of the Old Testament part of our Bible. And we have neglected, nearly totally neglected, any kind of attention to the second largest religion in the world, the Islamic religion. What does it mean? Well, let me give you just a few definitions of terms. The word Islam, which is used quite frequently in the news these days, it's a word that means submission to God, and it is the official name of the Muslim religion. The word Muslim means a disciple of Islam, of the Islamic religion, and literally it is one who submits. Mosque, that's a word we hear quite often. And what is a mosque? Oh, that's the Muslim church house, people say. It literally means a place of kneeling, and it isn't a church house, but it is the house of worship for the Islamic religion. The Quran, K-O-R-A-N, is the Bible of the Muslim world. It means the writing, the holy book, and it contains all of those writings that can be remembered, that other people remembered, that Muhammad said, plus the things that he himself dictated during his lifetime. Now, Muhammad himself was the responsible party for the Islamic religion. He was a, quote, prophet. We think he was a self-appointed prophet, but that would be an inflammatory expression if you were talking to a Muslim about it. And incidentally, I might just throw this in. It used to be a very common thing in the study of comparative religions in school for a textbook or a college professor to refer to this religion as the religion of the Mohammedan. If you ever have occasion to talk to those people, especially if you want to witness to them about Jesus, don't use that word. It's an insulting term, and they consider it an insult for you to call them a Mohammedan. And they will explain to you very quickly and logically, that means you think that I am a worshiper of Mohammed. I'm not a worshiper of Mohammed. The very first tenet of my religion is there is only one God, and His name is Allah, and Mohammed is His prophet. And I don't worship Mohammed, I worship Allah, I worship God. And so that's just, that has nothing really to do with my lesson, except I just thought I might throw it in, because there are a lot of people who are misinformed, and they think that those who are the adherents of the Islamic religion are Mohammedans, when in reality they are not. Who was Mohammed? He was a man born in the city of Mecca, out in the middle of the Arabian desert in AD 570. He believed that he was sent from God to destroy idols. And later on, when he grew up, though he was absolutely illiterate, I mean by that he had never gone to school any at all, he taught the Arabians to worship God. And he gave that God an Arabian name in the Arabic language, Allah. Now, it's the same God, you say. Yes, I believe it is. And they themselves think that they worship the same God as do the Christians and the Jews. The only thing is they object to the Jewish name, Jehovah, which is the name of our God, and they use instead the Arabic term Allah, but they consider this God to be the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob and so forth, and they believe that there was indeed a succession of prophets from their ancient forefather Abraham. They acknowledge, in other words, the lineage that they have to Abraham through Ishmael. But they think that instead of Jesus Christ being the epitome of the prophets of God, that Muhammad was that man, that he was the last man, that Jesus Christ was indeed a great prophet of God, and they accept him as being one of God's men, and they accept him as being a link in that line of prophets that started with Abraham, started with Adam, actually, and came down to Muhammad. But they also believe that in 570 A.D., Muhammad, the last prophet of God, was born, and that his word is always the last word in matters of religion so far as men are concerned. He thought that there was only one God, that Muhammad was the last prophet, that he succeeded Jesus Christ and all of the other biblical men. And how well did he succeed? Well, today, there are about 800 million people in the world, more than one-fifth of the population of the world who are of the Muslim religion. Most of them are in the Middle East. In fact, every one of the Middle East countries, except Israel, is a Muslim nation. But also, North Africa, Egypt and Libya are two examples, Pakistan, Indonesia, Turkey, Albania, part of Yugoslavia, a great part of India, are of the Muslim religion. I mentioned a moment ago that Muhammad himself was illiterate, but he dictated some words that he said were revelations given to him by God. And as these were written down, there were people who listened to his teaching, and even after his death, they remembered some of the things that Muhammad had said. They wrote them down, and all of these writings became a part of their sacred book called the Quran. The Quran and the Bible are very similar, incidentally, in some respect, because both books teach the unity of God. Muhammad was the seal of the prophets, the last in a series of prophets starting with Adam. Their book denounces usury, gambling, the eating of pork, alcohol, forbids lying, stealing, adultery, murder. Punishment is based upon an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They believe in capital punishment for killing, for criminals. They permit four wives, almsgiving, fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, once in a lifetime making a pilgrimage to their holy city, the city of Mecca, and to Medina if the Muslims can do that. They sum up the tenets of their religion under five headings that are called the five pillars of the Muslim faith. Number one, confessing that there is but one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Number two, prayer. 5 times per day, while always remembering to bow toward the city of Mecca from whatever part of the earth you happen to be. Almsgiving, except that instead of a tithe, they demand 2.5% of the income of each faithful Muslim. They believe that there is a certain month of the year called the month of Ramadan, which is a holy, very sacred month, and during that month, every faithful Muslim must fast from dawn until sunset. But I was reading in a book Brother Magnus has just today something that was interesting. That is, even though this is one of the 5 major tenets of the Islamic religion, that they fast from sunrise to sunset, after the sun goes down, they eat more than they ever did before, and their food bills are higher during the sacred month than they are any other month of the year, because they just live it up all night long in order to be able to fast the next day. They also believe that every person who is able to do so must make a pilgrimage once in a lifetime at least to that holy city of Mecca, to the place where the Prophet Muhammad was born. There is a rock there around which he is said to have gotten his revelation from God, and they must go and kiss that rock and touch that rock and make some kind of special worship and special offering to their God at that place. The day of the Muslim religion is Friday. That's their holy day, their sacred day. They do not, however, believe that one must just take off on Friday and do nothing, as do the Jews on their Saturday Sabbath. Rather, they believe that on Friday, the faithful Muslims must go, they must cleanse themselves, and they must attend a special prayer service in a mosque somewhere, where usually one of their leading men, their spiritual leaders, delivers a message of some kind and teaches from the Quran. And then the rest of the day, they may go and do whatever they please as if it were some kind of a normal day. The services are conducted by a spiritual leader by the name of Ayatollah. That word, incidentally, just means a spiritual ruler who is revered by the people, respected, honored by the people. And if there is one of the Ayatollahs who is especially revered by the people, who is worthy of some kind of special honor, then they always call him an imam. And that's the reason the Ayatollah Khomeini, of such great fame in Iran, is often referred to as the imam. Let's talk about him for just a moment. When Muhammad died in 632 A.D., his followers elected a number of successors after that who also died in their time. From these various successors, there developed a succession of family dynasties who gradually split into various branches of the Muslim sect. They have their denominations, just as Christianity became fragmented in time by differences in interpretation, differences in dogma and in practice. So the same thing is true in the Muslim religion. And they have divided up into a great number of denominations. If you'd like to take notes, I can give you very quickly the breakdown of these different Muslim denominations. They're the Shi'ites, the Sunnites, the Qadianites, the Baha'is, the Wahhabis, the Ikhwans, the Ismailis, and the Qajars. Did you get it all? Okay. Let's go on then. The two main denominations of the Islamic religion are the Sunnites and the Shi'ites. The Shi'ites believe that there is a bloodline of succession from Muhammad down to the present day, that like the Aaronic priesthood of the Old Testament, they believe that from Muhammad that a special leadership, that spiritual leadership of the Muslim people, is passed from father to son to grandson, and so on down the line within certain families. The Sunnites believe that these successors are to be elected by a democratic majority vote of the worshippers themselves. Those are the two main divisions of the Muslim religion. Saudi Arabia has the largest Sunnite group in the world. They're the ones who believe in the democratic election for their spiritual leaders. Iran is almost exclusively a Shi'ite nation who believes that the Spiritual leadership must be passed from father to son to grandson. And that's the reason, if you've been noticing in the papers recently, that's the reason that Mr. Khomeini has given special emphasis and special blessing to his son, who is also a priest of the Muslim religion and lives with his father in Iran. Incidentally, Iran has now become officially, I mean by that they have passed a law, that Iran is officially a Shiite Muslim nation. They have about 90 million people in that particular denomination of the Muslim religion. And they have established in Iran an Islamic government. Now that's one, like Saudi Arabia and like a few others, where the nation's political system is based on the teachings of the Quran. And regardless of what laws are passed, they are overruled if they are in dispute in any way whatsoever with their sacred writings, the Quran. Muhammad was not only a spiritual leader, but he was also a political leader, and he was a military leader. Islamic leaders, incidentally, don't make a separation. They have no such doctrine as the separation of church and state. They believe that if one is, by natural succession, a spiritual ayatollah, a spiritual leader, that he is also and should be regarded as the political leader and the military leader of the country. That's the reason that regardless of what the Iranian parliament does, the Ayatollah Khomeini may overrule those laws. Regardless of what the commander-in-chief of the army decides, the Ayatollah Khomeini may overrule those decisions if he so chooses by virtue of the office he holds. And that's the way it is in all of the Islamic world. Islam is a militant religion. And so all of the Muslims are militant. They believe as a matter of doctrinal conviction that if they go and fight some kind of a, quote, holy war in the name of their Allah, that they will have very special blessings in heaven if they die in battle in that kind of war. They believe that the Lord is going to allow them to have as many wives as they choose, and they're going to have servant girls to stand around and peel grapes and pop into their mouths, and someone to fan them when it gets warm and give them a drink of cool water when they get thirsty, and all of those things that sometimes people sort of have fantasies about concerning eternity in heaven. Another difference between the Shiite and the Sunnite theology is that the Sunnites believe that the Quran can be interpreted by scholars living as well as dead. But in the Shiite theology, there is the conviction that the Quran can be interpreted only by living scholars. Now that's significant, and here's why it is. Because in that Shiite theology, if, for example, the Ayatollah Khomeini says, now regardless of what the Quran says, this is the way it ought to be, they regard his word as being the infallible interpretation because he is a living scholar and times change, and because times change and circumstances change, therefore whatever the living scholar says is the correct interpretation of the Quran, that's the way it must be. And Mr. Khomeini believes that as a matter of conviction. He believes that he has the absolute proof that he is a man infallible when he interprets the laws of God. However, as you know, he's a man of very little experience in government and politics and military power of any kind. There is one thing, however, he does do that is sort of significant, especially in the light of our lesson tonight in the Bible. He hates Islam. He has a very intense hatred of the Jewish people. In fact, when he came to power after the Shah of Iran was deposed, the very first thing he did was to drive the Israeli representatives out of his country. He closed down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and gave it to the Palestinian Liberation Organization and invited them to send their representatives over there to occupy the former Israeli embassy. And then, of course, very well known what he did to the American embassy at the same time. Not only did he take over our embassy, but he imprisoned our personnel there for more than a year's time. Khomeini considers the culture of the West as his biggest enemy. In his religious conviction, he thinks of the United States as being the personification of Satan himself. Any decision he makes concerning the United States is, in his opinion, fully justified, because when he says something against the United States or does something against the United States, he believes that he is taking a stand against evil itself. If something should happen to him, I don't know this for sure now, this is a sort of an unofficial prediction, but if something should happen to him, he probably would become a Muslim saint, maybe revered in the eyes of especially the Iranian people as great as Muhammad himself. And there would be millions of Muslims throughout that Middle East country who would be willing to die. They would gladly go to war and die in his name and for his cause. Right now, as you know, if you've been reading the papers just in the last few days, right now, there is a tremendous power struggle going on in Iran. Now, someday, we'll be able to preach about what I'm talking about here tonight as past history. We'll be able to go back and show what happened in summer of 1981. But isn't it a thrill to see that we are living in fulfilled prophecy, and that we're actually a part of prophecy being fulfilled and enacted before our very eyes? We say, what do you mean by that, Brother Reed? Here is exactly, precisely what I mean by that. Ezekiel said in his prophecy that when Russia goes against the land of Israel, that Persia is going to be a part of his force, of his power. Oh, but you say, no, that won't work, because Persia is not a Russian satellite. Right at the present time, Russia doesn't really have a leader. The last three presidents, doesn't really have a leader. The last three presidents the Iranian people have elected have almost immediately been assassinated. And there are these various groups now that are just struggling and vying with each other for power in that Persian kingdom. And who's going to come out ahead, you say? Well, the Russian embassy is still open in Iran. The French embassy is all but closed. The Canadian and British and United States embassies are already closed. The Western powers, in other words, have been booted out. They've been told, pack up and get. The Russians are still there. Furthermore, in the analysis of the various reporters who seem to know exactly what they're talking about, the strongest group, the strongest political militant group in Iran today is a group called the Mujahideen, kind of hard to pronounce, but they are referred to as the Islamic Marxists, because since 1965, when that particular group came to power and became prominent in Iranian politics, they began to preach a new doctrine that had not been preached before, and that was that the Muslim people should not any longer be bound by what some prophet had concocted for them out in the middle of the Arabian desert 15 centuries ago, but instead they should be governed by the socio-economic conditions, unquote, of our modern times. That's almost the same thing as the communists use when they try to take over some little country somewhere, and they have guerrilla activity going on all over the world right at this present time using just about that same argument. What are you saying, preacher? I'm saying that it's not going to be too long until Iran is going to be a part of the communist camp. Maybe not on the surface, but the influence is there now. We don't have to say it will be there in a month or a year or something like that, because the influence is indisputably there right now. And it's apparent to most people who analyze the situation that Khomeini is a tool being used to bring things to a head. And it wouldn't be too hard right at this moment, for that matter, for Russian troops to sweep down across Iran's border. You know what they'd have to do that? Turn the key and start the engines and just drive a mile. Because Russia borders Iran on the north. And she has troops poised right now. Hundreds, thousands, and thousands of military vehicles of all sorts that are stationed right now on the north border of Iran, less than 1 mile from the Iranian. In Iran, right at this moment, as we sit here in this church building and think about it and talk about it. How close are we to the battle of Gog and Magog? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. But it's kind of like a little story I remember, a true story, incidentally. When I was living in Duncan, Oklahoma a few years ago, I had a beautiful yellow canary that my mother had given me. And it could sing, oh, as only a canary could. And I was real proud of it. She gave me the bird and the cage and everything that went with it. And we kept it in our house and did real fine. But then one day my oldest daughter came home from school with a shoebox with a little old baby cat in it that she found on the way home from school that someone had thrown out of the car. And she had compassion upon it, so she brought it home. And we kept it for her sake. And we kept it. And that was me. One Sunday, we inadvertently left the cat in the house when we went to church. And when we came back, the canary cage had been knocked over, spanned and all. It was obvious that the cat had climbed up on top of the bar in the kitchen and had made a flying leap and knocked the cage over, and the door came open and the canary got out, and there were yellow feathers and cat hairs all over that house. It looked as if they had gone into every room, on the beds, and on the top of the drapes we even found some feathers. No sign of the canary whatsoever, just a few feathers scattered around. And the cat was lying under the kitchen table asleep. Now, I couldn't prove it. I mean, if I were forced to go on the witness stand in a court of law and testify, I could not actually prove by deductive evidence that the cat ate the canary. But I could sure make a strong case out of circumstantial evidence. And I'm not saying to you tonight that I'm smart enough and intuitive enough and that I'm a good enough analyst of current events to be able to say to you that the Lord's going to come tomorrow or next year or some other time, because the Bible has warned us not to do that. But I can make a strong case based on really good circumstantial evidence that it won't be wrong. And the Lord didn't say, now when everything gets wrapped up and you can see the whole package complete, then you can know that it's about ready for the Lord to come. He did not say that. What did he say? What is our motto text for this week? When you see these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your head, for your redemption draws nigh. Of that day and hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels in heaven. But Peter said, the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and doctrine? Will you stand up with me, please? If you know someone here tonight who is lost, will you pray for them? And as we sing, let us just pray that the Holy Spirit will move in the hearts of our friends and our loved ones and our acquaintances here tonight who are unsaved, but here in this house, they might realize that time is so short. And what a wonderful opportunity to just turn away from your life and turn to the Lord Jesus and say, Lord, I've been out of your service and I've never known you before, but that's going to change tonight. I've decided to follow Jesus. I've decided to be his disciple, and I trust him now to be my Savior. You want to come and rededicate your life to the Lord, Christian, child of God? Would you like to come and join this church tonight by letter, paper, promise of a letter from the sister church? Is there something else that you feel God would have you to do tonight? Why don't you come right now? Just step out from wherever you are right now. The pastor will be here.